Mammograms do not save lives. In fact, they actually cost lives.
Dr. Jen Simmons is a former breast cancer surgeon who walked away from the conventional model and is now leading a revolution in breast health. She's here to blow the lid off the mammogram myth, introduce us to technology that's both safer and smarter, and share what it really takes to prevent and heal breast cancer.
In reality, the only thing that early detection has done is create more customers.
If you've ever felt uneasy about mammograms, this episode is for you. Let's dig in. Dr. Jen, you spent years within the system as a breast cancer surgeon.
Yeah.
What did you believe about breast cancer back then that you no longer believe now?
You know, it's so funny. It's a great question. There are so many things that I believed to be true for 20 years of my practice through training up until the time that I left surgery. Probably the biggest one is that we were taught that breast cancer is just some random happenstance, right? It's bad luck, or it's genetics, or it's something that the patient has no control over. And although I hate conspiracy theories, I understand why that belief existed. It's because the doctors want to feel as if what they're doing is the meaningful thing, and they have to believe in what they're doing. So if health is created by the patient, if disease is reversed by the patient and what they're doing, where does that leave the doctor? Right? So it's so contradictory to that belief system. So instead, you take all the power away from the individual and you tell them that it's your genetics and you can't do anything about it, or that it's just bad luck and something that happened. And so you have no control, right? I'm going to take over control and I'm going to give you a surgery or radiation or a drug, and I'm going to change that for you. Right. And it's this whole transfer of power, and it was the wrong thing. And I did it for a really long time. And within that system, all the focus is on the tumor, right? Because that is how our conventional medical system is designed. It's all about symptom management. So we have all of this focus on the tumor, but the tumor is not the problem. The tumor is the symptom of the problem. And until we back up 10 steps and realize why that tumor is there, we're not helping people. We're not getting them to another place, a better place. We're just taking them across a bridge from sick to slightly less sick, because you no longer have a tumor in your body. But all the inflammation, all the toxins, everything that led them to that point is still there. Sometimes it's worse. So I believed that I was truly helping when I was a breast surgeon. I really did. I couldn't have done it if I didn't believe in what I was doing. But it wasn't until I got my own diagnosis and spent my own time as a patient that I realized that what we are doing is so wrong, and we're focused on completely the wrong thing. And once I had that revelation, once I had that experience, it was a bell that I couldn't unring. And I knew that not only was I not helping as a surgeon, but I also wasn't living my mission, because I always knew that I was put here to change the conversation around breast cancer, to change how we diagnose breast cancer, how we treat breast cancer, how we reverse breast cancer. I knew that I was always meant to help millions of women. And so I think that that's why I got my own diagnosis, so that my eyes could be opened. Because when you're in that conventional medical space, it is so hard to see the landscape. It's so hard to understand that. And you really do believe that everything that you were taught is true.
Yeah. Was there a single moment within that journey for you where your faith in conventional cancer care was kind of shattered, or was it more of a slow unraveling?
Absolutely. So I went into surgery because I had a first cousin. Her name was Linda Creed. She was a singer-songwriter in the 1970s and 1980s, way before your time. And she was beautiful, brilliant, larger than life. She was my hero. She wrote 54 hits in all, and her most famous song that she ever wrote was The Greatest Love of All. So she wrote that song, and Whitney Houston released that song to the world in March of 1986. And at that time, it spent 14 weeks at the top of the charts. And there literally wasn't a person on earth who didn't know that song. And I was 16 years old at the time. And here is my cousin, the literal rock star, right? And my cousin never knew what became of that song because she died 1 month after Whitney Houston released it.
Wow.
And I was 16 years old and my hero died. And her life and ultimately her death gave birth to my life's purpose. So I become a doctor, the first doctor in my family. I become a surgeon. I become the first fellowship trained breast surgeon in Philadelphia. And I became the first oncoplastic surgeon in Pennsylvania. And I did that really well and for a really long time. And about 15 years into my career, when I am arguably at the top of my career, I go from probably being one of the most high-performing people you've ever met in your life to I can't walk across the room because I don't have the breath in my body. So I have this really intense 3-day workup, and at the end of those 3 days, find myself sitting in the office of my friend and colleague and physician, and he tells me that I need surgery and chemo and radiation and all these things that I say all day, every day, without hesitation or reservation. But when those words are coming at you, believe me, they have different meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And so all I could hear in that time and space, despite the fact that I am a fellowship-trained surgeon, I'm running a cancer program, despite the fact that I don't know anything outside of conventional medicine, and you can call it God, and you can call it universe, and you can call it whatever higher power you ascribe to, but all I could hear in that time and space was, there's something more, go find it. And my doctor warned me that I would die. And I understand why he said that, right? He was telling me what he really believed to be true. And I still couldn't unhear that voice telling me there's something more, go find it. So God is good. And I go on a journey to heal myself. And in very short order, I find myself sitting in a lecture hall, and this tall, lanky guy walks on the stage, big toothy grin, and he introduces himself as a functional medicine physician. Now, at this point, I'm a doctor for about 20 years. I'm still cynical. I'm still my snooty booty self. And all I can think of is like, there's no such thing as a functional medicine physician. What is this quack talking about? And then I remember that I'm sick and I'm there for a reason. So I check that big fat ego at the door and I tune in, and thank God I did.
Wow.
Because what this man would have to say over the next 2 hours would completely change how I feel about medicine, how I feel about my role, how I feel about my illness, how I felt about my intentions for the rest of my life. Because as it turns out, the quack is Dr. Mark Hyman.
Wow.
And what he would teach me on that day is that what we were talking about before, what we're focused on in conventional medicine are the symptoms. In the area of cancer, we're focused on the tumor, but the tumor is not the problem. It's a symptom of the problem. And unless we back up 10 steps and figure out why that cancer is there, why that tumor is there, why that symptom is there, what's driving it, then how are we ever going to get better? So in our conventional medical system, really the only way to get into is to fail, right? Our conventional medical system is built on failure. Unless you fail, unless you get sick, doctors don't get paid, hospitals don't get paid, pharmaceutical companies don't make any money, no one makes any money unless you fail. So what is going to happen? They're going to drive us towards failure.
Yeah, it's all set up for the worst case scenario.
Set up for that. Every step along the way, it's set up for that. Our food system is set up for that. Everything is set up for that. And we don't reward health.
Yeah.
And I did not know that. I did not recognize that. And now, in retrospect, it's very obvious. But when you're in that system, you can't see it.
Well, good for you for having an open mind. A lot of people, I think, would have just shut down and decided to not pay attention in that seminar, like you were mentioning. But you were open enough to hear a different perspective that was the opposite from everything that you had learned and practiced. And that yes. takes a lot of courage.
It does. Well, I got a lot braver because I did spend the next 3 years just immersed in the study of functional medicine, because even though the principles that we learn about in functional medicine are taught to us in medical school, in our first year of medical school, and then we're told, forget all of that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we learn all of the biochemistry, we learn all of the physiology, and then we say, forget all that. Here are the symptoms, put them together, give people a diagnosis, and then prescribe. Prescribe a medicine, prescribe a surgery, prescribe a procedure. And that is what embodies the rest of your medical career. And unless you have some kind of profound experience like mine, you never look outside. And the people that are in my space now, the people that are doing what I do now, they're almost always pain to purpose. They either got their own diagnosis, or they watched their parents suffer, or their siblings suffer, or God forbid their child suffer. And they looked for answers and couldn't find them inside of the conventional medical world, because they don't exist inside of the conventional medical world. And it's intentional. Unfortunately, it's intentional. The pharmaceutical companies absolutely create the medical school curriculum. And they don't want you to know.
Yeah, I think a lot of people forget that this is a business.
Yes.
And there's a lot more driving it than
business.
Very big.
Yeah.
And it's not about helping people become the most healthy and optimized version of themselves. It's about making money at the end of the day.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it in the most basic of ways, we know that food is medicine, right? And what you put in your body is your biggest exposure to the outside world. 80% of our exposure to the outside world is through what we put in our mouth, right?
What's the other 20%?
What we eat and what we drink, environmental, what we breathe, what we put on our skin.
Yeah.
But 80% of our exposure to the outside world is through what we eat and what we drink. And as physicians, and I went to one of the top medical schools in the country, as physicians, we are given 15 hours worth of training, 15 hours in our first year of medical school, and then never again.
In nutrition, that's it.
15 hours worth of nutrition.
Wow.
Training in our first year of medical school, and then never again. Never.
And speaking of money-making industries, October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and we have seen decades of pink ribbons and marches and Save the Tatas, but what have we actually accomplished with any of that?
Nothing. We've raised a fortune. We've raised a lot of money to feed the already greedy, harmful system, right? Because we don't need another drug. Another drug is not saving us.
And that's what
another
I think a lot of people...
never saving us.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people understand that. That really, these organizations, they're raising money purely to fund new drugs. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, so new drugs, new devices.
Yeah.
And just think about it logically, what we talked about before. There's no way to get into the system without getting sick, without failing, right? And the system does not want you healthy because it doesn't help them. So why would they invent a cure for cancer?
Mm-hmm.
They're never inventing a cure for cancer. They want you as a customer.
Mm-hmm.
And so they may invent things that prolong your existence, although most of those most of those things are very, very toxic. And the life that people live on these very, very toxic drugs is very compromised. But they're not creating cures. They're creating customers. They're a business. They are a business. And the other problem is that, you know, then we know what builds health. What builds health is good food and good clean water and being outside and having meaningful connections and relationships and living with purpose and prioritizing sleep and living in circadian rhythm, right? Mm-hmm. That's what builds health. But you can't trademark any of that. Like, there's no company that can make money off of you being in the sunshine.
Yeah.
Or off of you eating whole foods. Or even, you know, when we think about the supplement companies and how the FDA is now getting involved in trying to control all of it, this is coming from the pharmaceutical industry because you can't trademark a molecule of nature. So things like reishi mushroom or turkey tail mushroom, which are included in cancer protocols all around the world, are not included in the United States because you can't trademark a molecule of nature. Or even, you know, we talk about hormones being bad and hormones causing cancer. That whole narrative is built out of the fact that bioidentical hormones, you can't trademark them. So the companies can't make any money off of them. So they call them bad and then create these synthetic hormones, stuff like tamoxifen, call that good, and prescribe it to people with cancer. But all those synthetic hormone-like substances cause cancer. Tamoxifen, the drug given very, very commonly to women who have premenopausal hormone-positive breast cancer, that drug causes cancer.
What does it do, actually?
So it blocks something called the ER-alpha receptor, but there's lots of things that block the ER-alpha receptor, like melatonin. But you can't trademark melatonin because it's a molecule of nature, like luteolin, like green tea, like genistein, which we find in soy. So there are a whole bunch of natural substances that block that same receptor. So instead of taking tamoxifen, which actually causes cancer, you instead can eat all of these foods that actually block that same ER-alpha receptor and build your health and prevent cancer or prevent recurrence.
That's fascinating.
Yes.
Yeah, and we were talking.
Why aren't we talking about that?
Right, right. I mean, it just makes sense when you say it. Like, these things can't be patented, trademarked. And so we're going to demonize these natural, I don't know what you would call them, natural cures, natural, you know, health-boosting compounds.
But it's food.
And instead create a synthetic version.
Right.
That isn't the same, but it can be profited from.
Yes.
And that's what they prescribe.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, another thing that I think about as we're out here in beautiful wine country is resveratrol. Resveratrol is one of those things that blocks the ER-alpha receptor and prevents breast cancer, prevents metastasis, prevents recurrence. But you can't trademark a molecule of nature.
Do you recommend people get resveratrol from drinking red wine or taking it in an isolated form?
I do recommend taking it in an isolated form, only because the alcohol is a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a toxin. It's hard to get around that.
Yeah.
So we now have more awareness about breast cancer than ever before, but breast cancer rates are continuing to steadily rise.
Yes,
so
they are.
What's missing from the conversation?
Yeah. So first of all, we are not living on our mother's earth. We're not living on our grandmother's earth. We're not living on anything that even resembles that. And the number of toxins that we have in our environment is exponentially more than ever before. And that's definitely contributing to breast cancer incidence and breast cancer diagnoses. But I think the really curious part about it is, if we look at the number of women that die every year from breast cancer, that number is steady. That number has not materially changed. And this is the biggest problem we are looking too hard for breast cancer. And that may seem a little harsh, but let me explain it. Breast cancer, prostate cancer, other chronic conditions like high blood pressure, diabetes. Well, I think we should look harder for diabetes, but maybe that's not a great example. But these other examples that I'm talking about, we are lowering the threshold again and again and again for who meets criteria for treatment. And it's only for the purpose of treating more people. We are not helping more people. When we lower that cholesterol number to put more people on statins, we're not saving lives. We're not saving people from heart attacks. And in fact, if you go on a statin, you're 63% more likely to get diabetes.
Wow.
We are not helping people with statins. If you lower the threshold for high blood pressure and put more people on high hypertensive medication, you're going to have more people with hypotension and falls and complications as a result of doing that. We're not helping anyone with that.
That's really interesting because early detection is really celebrated within the conventional cancer world. But you're saying, and I'm going to kind of try to give my best knowledge on this, but everyone has cancer cells, correct?
That's correct.
And so we're detecting things that have not yet developed into a form of cancer that actually needs to be treated.
That's exactly.
And administering these drugs that are actually harming people when they're not necessary.
Yes, that's exactly right. So we are over-diagnosing and over-treating, and we're doing that with great frequency. 20 to 30% of the breast cancer diagnoses every single year don't need to be made.
Wow.
And just to put that in perspective, we diagnosed 300,000 women last year with breast cancer. If 20 to 30% of them would have never developed the disease, we are talking about 60 to 90,000 women last year that were unnecessarily diagnosed with and treated for breast cancer.
It's a lot of money for pharmaceutical companies.
A lot of money for pharmaceutical companies, for hospitals, for cancer programs, which are the most profitable part of any medical center, is their cancer program. And what do you do to these women? You materially change the rest of their life. That is a bell you cannot unring for them. And they are suffering because you take a woman and you treat her for breast cancer using the standard treatments because people are so afraid to not use these standard treatments. So they have surgery and they have radiation and they go on these drugs for 5 years. And what happens to them? Because the medical oncologists don't think about them after 5 years. For 5 years, they're very focused on them. But after 5 years, they don't think about them. And where do we leave these women as we rob them of their estrogen after 5 years? We tell them you should be grateful to be alive. And they are grateful. But it is very hard to feel grateful when you can't sleep, you can't think, you're depressed, you're anxious, you've gained weight, your breasts are deformed or absent, your joints ache, your bones ache, your skin is dry, your hair is dry, everything is dry. Sex is unwanted, painful, you have no libido. Your relationship is suffering or absent. It is not easy to feel grateful when all of this is happening. And yet, this is how we are leaving most women after we treat them for breast cancer. Now, listen, if they have aggressive disease and they need this treatment, absolutely. Absolutely. I am not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I am not saying that breast cancer isn't a serious disease. It is. But for a small population, most of the women that we treat for breast cancer are either completely or partially overtreated. And we are giving them treatments that materially change the rest of their lives when the primary disease would have never changed the rest of their lives.
Wow.
We are doing the wrong thing, and we are doing it with great frequency. There are 4 million breast cancer survivors alive in the United States right now. And 1 million of them never needed to be diagnosed. 1 million women.
And they're suffering for it.
Yes. We are doing the wrong thing.
Let's talk about mammograms, because so many women view this as a non-negotiable life-saving tool. But what are we missing when we think about mammograms?
Yeah. So remember that this has been one of the greatest ad campaigns that ever existed, right? Everyone believes that mammograms save lives. I'm not just talking about lay people. I'm talking about professionals. I'm talking about breast imagers, radiologists, all doctors of all kinds, practitioners of all kinds. They believe that mammograms save lives. And the reason that they believe that is because it has been so drilled into us from the time that I was a medical student through my training. Mammograms save lives. They say it again and again and again. So much so that no one looks at your data. And this has literally become an issue of morality rather than an issue of science. Because the facts are that mammograms do not save lives. And in fact, if you look at the ramifications of mammograms, they actually cost lives.
What are some of the ramifications?
So if you look at the real data, if you screen 2,000 women over 10 years, you will potentially save one life, maybe. You will cause 10 to 20 women to be diagnosed with and treated for a disease that would have never affected them in their lifetime. You will cause 100 to 200 women to have studies that they don't need, biopsies that they don't need. And if you look at the population over time, women, if you screen them every year for 10 years, 50% of them will be called back for additional studies. 50%. So every mammogram that you get is more radiation. Now, lots of times people say, well, there's radiation everywhere, there's background radiation, and you don't tell people not to go to the airport, you don't tell people to not go on a plane, and that's true. I don't tell people not to go on an airplane or to the airport, or I think we should try to avoid as much radiation as we can. But there is a vast difference between the background radiation that you get from sunlight or going to the airport or going on an airplane and the focused cone down radiation that you get to the traumatized tissues of the breast.
Of course. And it's a spectrum.
I don't care if your mammogram hurt you or not. I mean, like, I get these messages from these tough women. Oh, mammograms don't hurt. Well, the bottom line is that they are applying anywhere from 20 to 50 pounds of pressure to your breast.
Oof.
So if you're tough and that doesn't hurt you, God bless you. I don't like it.
Sounds very uncomfortable.
Right?
I've never had one.
Very uncomfortable. So there's no doubt that we are radiating the traumatized tissues of the breast. And there is no argument. Radiation causes cancer. People all the time say, where's your proof that mammograms cause cancer? And I'm like, I'm sorry. Where's my proof that radiation causes cancer? Really? You want me to prove that? Because that's been done.
Yeah.
Like, I don't need to prove that radiation causes cancer. That is a fact, right? And yet we ignore it because we've created this issue of morality around mammogram.
Yeah, like you're doing people a disservice.
Yes.
And you don't want them to live, basically.
Yes.
If you're not willing to do this for them, or if you're not willing to do this for yourself.
So this is where the mammograms save lives and early detection saves lives. But in reality, the only thing that early detection has done is create more customers, because the women who are going to have aggressive disease are not being picked up on mammogram. These women have what we call interval cancers, where they're the ones that had a normal mammogram 3 months ago, and all of a sudden they feel a lump in their breast. Right? Or what seems like all of a sudden. These aggressive cancers, we're not changing anything for them by screening with mammogram. And the only thing that we are doing by screening with mammogram is creating more disease, or creating some of it with the radiation. And we are picking up these lesions that would have never developed into clinical disease. And we have the studies to prove that mammograms don't save lives. Each big study that is done proves this time and time again. The Swedish study, 600,000 women, 300,000 screened with mammogram, 300,000 just get self-breast examination. Because it's universal healthcare, everyone has the same access to care. Everyone has the same kind of care. The same exact number of women die of breast cancer in each group. And the only difference is that if you use mammogram to screen, you will diagnose 20 to 30% more breast cancers. Same exact thing in the Canadian breast cancer screening study, except now we're looking at young women, looking at women 40 to 59, because maybe we're not helping older women, but maybe we're helping younger women. So look at the data. And when you look at the data, 90,000 women participated in the study. Again, universal healthcare, so everyone has the same access to care. Everyone gets the same kind of care. The 45,000 get screened with mammogram, 45,000 just get self-breast examination or examination with their doctor every year. The same exact findings, the same exact number of women die of breast cancer in each group. And the only difference is if you use mammogram to screen, you're going to diagnose 20 to 30% more cancers.
Wow. And despite this information, despite this data, this is something that you get a ton of pushback for talking about.
A ton.
Why are people so resistant to hearing this information?
Because it becomes an issue of morality, right? And people genuinely believe. I get messages every single day, mammogram saved my life. They've been so conditioned to believe that if it was found on the mammogram, that mammogram saved their life. But the truth is that unless you present with clinical disease, that mammogram did not save your life. And in fact, that mammogram might have been the reason why you got diagnosed with breast cancer at all. Because for 20 to 30% of these women that get diagnosed with mammogram, they would have never developed clinical disease, ever.
That's wild. And you mentioned biopsies earlier. I've heard this idea that tumors are actually the body's way of kind of containing cancer to one area. And if we disturb the tumor with a biopsy, or maybe even with surgery, that we are letting these cancer cells spread unnecessarily. I don't even remember where I heard that, but is there any truth to that?
So there is some truth to that for some cancers. And I do not believe, with rare exception, if you have a different kind of cancer called an angiosarcoma of the breast, you cannot biopsy that. You cannot violate that. And there are different kind of cancers like renal cell carcinoma that you would get in your kidney, different sarcomas. These are cancers that you get in the bone or the muscle, things like that. Those you really should not violate because they spread very easily in the bloodstream. For most breast cancers, for most run-of-the-mill breast cancers, I do not believe that biopsy creates metastasis. And I don't think that there is any information that supports biopsying breast cancer causing metastasis. And that's because if we look at the survival numbers for breast cancer, most of these, all of them have undergone biopsy, right? There would have been no other way for us to know that they had breast cancer. And most breast cancer is completely survivable. So if biopsies really caused metastasis, we wouldn't have the survival numbers that we have.
Yeah.
And the reason that our survival numbers look so good and we spend so much time like patting ourselves on the back about it is because we're diagnosing all of these women, 60 to 90,000 women every year, that didn't even need that diagnosis.
They hadn't developed the full-blown disease.
And they wouldn't develop the full-blown disease. So it's like, they don't really have a problem, but we'll treat you for it and then take credit.
We
changed your life. And we did change your life, but not for the better.
Right.
And even Otis Brawley, who is the former head of the American Cancer Society, said that mammogram does not do what it had set out and intended to do. And women who believed that they were helped by mammogram were actually hurt by mammogram. There is absolutely no benefit to using mammogram for screening. Zero. Zero. Now, when they set out on the mammographic screening program, the intention was that it would save lives and save breasts. And so, you know, I have always said, even if it doesn't save lives, but it does save rep, that's a pretty noble cause, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if we're saving breasts, that's worthwhile. But when you look at the data, when you use mammogram to screen, the mastectomy rate only goes up by 20%. So we're not saving lives, we're not saving breasts. What are we doing? We're torturing women for nothing. Well, not for nothing. We're feeding the system. We're creating cuts.
Yeah. Tell us about QT imaging.
Yeah.
What sets QT imaging apart in terms of accuracy and safety?
Yeah. So I think the key word that you said there was safety. And this is my main message. This is the soapbox that I will not get off of. We are talking about screening. We are talking about a healthy population. We are talking about women who we have no reason to believe that they have disease. How can we ethically, how can we morally expose these women to harms?
Mm-hmm.
How can we expose them to radiation? How? How can we expose them to gadolinium? I mean,
what is gadolinium?
It's a heavy metal that's used in the process of screening for breast cancer with MRI.
Okay.
And
that's another form of screening that's recommended within
It's currently the gold standard for women with dense breasts, for women who have high risk, for women with breast implants.
Do women with dense breasts have a more, like, are they more likely to develop breast cancer?
So it depends where they are in their life. If you are premenopausal, if you are of childbearing age, you are supposed to have dense breasts. Your breasts are prepared to feed a child. That's what they're supposed to have. So when you look at the breast, it is made up of four tissues. It's made up of glandular tissue, the milk-producing tissue that generates milk and that you use to feed your child. It's made up of fat. It's made up of connective tissue that kind of holds everything together. And that's all in a skin envelope. And when you are premenopausal, you are supposed to have an abundance of glandular tissue. You're supposed to have dense breasts. That is normal. So it makes me insane when they tell a 40-year-old that she has dense breasts.
Like, it's a bad thing.
No, duh. Of course she has dense breasts. She's supposed to have dense breasts. That's a good thing. The problem happens when women go through menopause and they have less estrogen and they get less estrogen stimulation, their breast tissue should undergo regression. And we should start to see, year after year, less breast density. When we don't, it's because there's a lot of inflammation there. That is a risk factor for breast cancer.
Okay.
And it's these women that have increasing breast density after childbirth, or even, you know, as years go on, they have increasing breast density. These are women that are at higher risk for breast cancer. That's for sure true. But it's not the density of their breasts. It's the inflammation that's driving that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, I got us off track a little bit, but I want to hear more about the QT imaging story.
So my thing is, we cannot expose healthy tissue to toxins, right? Can't expose them to radiation, can't expose them to gadolinium. It's the wrong thing to do. So how do we safely screen for breast cancer? I'm so glad you asked. First of all, I think that everyone should be doing self-breast examination. No one is ever going to know you better than you know yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And newsflash, every single woman thinks her breasts are lumpy. We just need to own our lumps. Everyone needs to own their lumps, right?
You need
to know what your breasts feel like when they're normal so that you can know when there's been a change.
Yeah.
And you can recognize a change. And if there's been a change, that is when you go to your doctor and say, hey, doc, this doesn't feel like my breast. I know what my breast feels like. This is not normal. I have pain, or I have dimpling, or I have nipple discharge, or I have whatever I have. I have a lump. right? And then you can have it investigated. And incidentally, that is not screening, right? Then you're talking about diagnostic. But everyone should be doing self-breast examination once a month. You don't need to examine your breasts every day. We don't need to be obsessed about it. Once a month, if you are premenopausal, you're going to do it on day 7 of your cycle because that's when your breasts are the least stimulated.
Okay.
And if you're postmenopausal, feel them on the 1st or whenever you're going to remember to do it, set an alarm. Just do it, right? Put it on your calendar once a month. Okay. Then, everyone should be doing the ARIA test. This is the TEARS test.
Mm.
This is a simple, inexpensive, at-home test that I truly believe will be the determination in the future of who does and who does not get imaging. It's a small piece of paper that you put in the corner of your eye, close your eye for 5 minutes, send that paper off to the company. A week and a half later, you get the result. It's either negative or you have a clinically positive result. Now, what it's looking for are two inflammatory proteins, the S100A8 and S100A9 proteins that when they are found at high levels together, it is highly predictive of breast cancer.
Wow.
In fact, if you have a clinically positive result, if you have breast cancer, this test will pick it up 93% of the time.
I've never heard of this.
Way better than any imaging. So the company recommends that women over 30 do this test every year, and it is a real-time biologic assessment of your risk to breast cancer. Now, the sensitivity of that test is a little lower. The sensitivity is around 58%, which means that 42% of the time, women without breast cancer will have a positive result on this test.
And does it just screen for breast cancer?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. It only screens for breast cancer because these proteins are specific for breast cancer. So 42% of the time, if you don't have breast cancer, you will have a positive result here. I want to be clear, there are no false positives of this test, because if you have a clinically significant result, even if you have imaging right now and you have no radiologic evidence of breast cancer, you have the inflammatory precursors to breast cancer. And if you did nothing, 11% of these women in 6 months will present with clinical disease.
Wow. So 42% don't actually have cancer at the time of the test, but they have the markers, the precursors for it, yes. And 11% of that 42% will go on to develop it.
Yes, in the next 6 months.
Wow.
So what you have here is opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the opportunity here to actually prevent the disease. And I think that that is amazing. I mean, when have we ever had this opportunity before to like have a telescope and look, this is what's in your future, but you have the opportunity now to change that.
Yeah. I mean, it really puts the responsibility back on the human, on the patient to know their body, and which I think is really empowering. Yeah, I think that's how it should be.
So much more power than we think.
Right. It's like, yeah, it's just an opportunity to change this before it develops into something catastrophic.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's so unlike that conventional medical system, which is let's wait till you get sick.
Yeah.
Right?
So the self-breast examinations along with the eye test,
yes.
Which is, what was it called again?
The ARIA test. So it's ARIA.care.
Okay. And that's those are things everyone should just be doing.
Everyone should be
non-invasive,
easy. Non-invasive, inexpensive. If you use my code DRJEN20, DRJENN20, you'll get 20% off the test. Very, very affordable.
Okay.
So that is like everyone is doing that. Then if you have a clinically positive ARIA test, or we've just been so conditioned to get imaging, mm-hmm. right? It's what we're taught. Early detection is key, right? So for women who choose to get imaging, I just want you to be safe. I just don't want any harm to come to you. And so the imaging that I recommend, it's called QT, and I have imaging centers which use this imaging along with the exam and ARIA. And so at my center's Perfection Imaging, we are using this technology that uses sound waves transmitted through a water bath to create a true 3D reconstruction of the breast without pain, without compression, without radiation. So we are taking the fear, the pain, the trauma out of breast cancer screening and replacing it with facts, with loving kindness, and with caring. Because I don't think that you should be hurt or punished or endangered because you're trying to do the right thing. I mean, if you're screening, you're trying to do the right thing. So let's help these women do the right thing. So I only have 2 centers open in the United States right now, but I'm opening 50 over the next 5 years because I want to make sure that every woman who wants access to this technology gets access to this technology.
So is this something that that only you are offering currently, or why aren't more people offering this? Is it hard to get find? I mean, I know soon it will be more accessible with these 50 centers that you're opening.
It will be more accessible, and there are some hospital systems that are adopting it, but it's been very slow to adopt for several reasons. First of all, I'm sure you've noticed that medicine doesn't change so fast.
Yeah.
Right? It generally takes 20 years to change practice guidelines. 20 years, right? That's how behind we are.
Yeah, if you think about the rate of
20 years.
Technology, information, increases so quickly. 20 years is like we're so behind.
But I mean, look, we are still practicing under the guidelines of the Women's Health Initiative, who in 2003 said that hormones cause breast cancer. Right? And we're still practicing under those guidelines, even though the paper's been retracted. There's overwhelming data that not only are hormones, not only do they not cause breast cancer, but they're actually protective.
The bioidentical hormone.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But even the conjugated equine estrogen that was used in that study was found to be protective against breast cancer.
Wow.
So medicine is way behind. It does not move fast. Part of that is probably a good thing because we just had a whole disaster where we put something on the market without researching it and we hurt millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of people. Mm-hmm. So under normal circumstances, it's probably good that it doesn't move that fast. But QT is FDA cleared, and the difference between FDA cleared and FDA approved is devices get cleared and drugs get approved.
Okay.
So people say, oh, well, it's cleared, but it's not approved. Yes, that's true. And it will never be approved because it's not a drug.
Yeah.
Right?
Different terminology.
And it's not a treatment, right? It's a screening tool that I believe should be used in conjunction with other screening tools. I don't believe in doing standalone anything. So part of the reason for the lack of adoption is medicine is slow. Part of the reason is that think about all of these breast cancer screening programs and how invested they are in their mammogram program. Because, you know, those mammogram machines cost nearly $1 million.
Wow.
In their MRI, and those MRIs cost between $1.5 and $3 million each, right? So they have a lot of money to recover to pay for these machines. And beyond that, the radiologists are very happy with what they're doing and getting paid to read 1, 2, 3, and 4 tests. They don't really want to trade that in for one test, right? And lastly, they have to train. It's not intuitive. So in order to read QT, you have to go back and train. And I've heard radiologists say, I've looked at those images. They're blurry. They're this, they're that. Yes, if you're trying to look at them on your standard reader, there's specific equipment, there's specific readers for QT. So they have to go train. They need new equipment. It's not we're just going to start to read this. It's a totally different system, which I believe is part of the downfall. I think it should have been built on the conventional platform. I think that would have led to earlier adoption, but it is what it is. There are very, very, very major hospital systems which have adopted it. The world is going to be a far different place this time next year because of these very major hospital systems that have adopted it. But in the meantime, I'm not letting it stop me. People will start to adopt it. Change is coming. Change is happening. And in the meantime, I'm doing what I know is right. And I very much feel called to this. And even if I didn't have 2T, I would feel the way that I feel about mammogram and about mammographic screening, because I don't believe that anyone should ever use mammogram for screening. But now I have the ARIA test, I have QT, and I feel so justified in standing on this soapbox saying what I say.
Yeah, there's other options that aren't harmful.
That are 100% safe, 100% painless. And we can completely change what breast cancer screening looks like, what it feels like. We can completely change the experience, and I am.
It's amazing.
I am forever changing how we screen for breast cancer. Now, I want to be clear, I am not saying that no one will never, ever have a mammogram again. I'm not saying that. Because if you have a lump in your breast, if you have a symptom like nipple discharge or nipple retraction or some other symptom that is suspicious for breast cancer, you're going to get a mammogram and an ultrasound and maybe an MRI, right? Because that's the language that the surgeons speak. That's the language that that conventional medicine speaks. And you won't be able to get help without doing those standard tests. So I have a bundle that will help protect you against radiation that has all of these beautiful antioxidants in it. And so you'll take that, or I have a bundle that will protect you against absorbing the gadolinium if you need an MRI, and all of them can be found on my website, Real Health MD. But in the meantime, if that diagnostic study is going to allow you to get help, mm-hmm. right? I am not saying you're never going to have another one of those studies. I am saying that we have to protect the screening population. We have to stop over-imaging. We have to stop over-diagnosing, and we have to stop over-treating.
What about thermography? I've heard this talked about a lot as an alternative to mammograms. What are your thoughts on thermography?
Yeah, I love thermography. I use thermography. Thermography is looking for a heat signal, and it's indicative of inflammation, but it is not a screening tool for breast cancer. It's not reliable enough. And because it's not reliable enough, that's why it has been so shunned by the conventional medical community. So I use it when I'm looking for a source of inflammation. If I'm like, if I'm a little dumbfounded and can't figure out where someone's inflammation is coming from, like it's measuring on their labs, but I can't find it in their body, it's not obvious, I do use thermography for that. But I don't use it as a breast cancer screening study.
What about Pronuvo? That's another one that a lot of people are talking about.
Yeah, so that's a non-contrast MRI. So I really like it because of that, because it's not dangerous. You're not putting anyone in harm's way. It is a screening tool. It's not a great screening tool for the breast because I think it has a threshold of about a centimeter. But I think that it is a way of screening your body and maybe finding something early. It's not preventative. Let's be clear. It's not. It has nothing to do with prevention, but it is a safe tool for early detection.
What are some early metabolic red flags that can develop before breast cancer ever occurs?
I love this question because this is something that we're not talking about enough. And this was the focus of my talk at A4M, the American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine. If we would screen for metabolic dysfunction with the same vigor that we screen for breast cancer, we would be a hell of a lot healthier as a society. Metabolic dysfunction is the precursor to the development of breast cancer because it's having this profoundly negative effect on our internal chemistry.
and the precursor to so many other diseases.
It's the precursor to chronic disease. For many chronic diseases, diabetes, hypertension, heart disease. And our providers, again, because of the way that our system is set up, they're only trained to recognize failure, right? So all they're doing when they're looking at people's basic labs every year is they're looking at a fasting glucose and they're looking at a hemoglobin A1C, which is your average glucose over a 3-month period of time. And so they're letting these glucoses go that are, you know, 100, 110 as a fasting glucose. And they're saying, oh, just watch what you eat and maybe exercise a little more and maybe lose a little weight. And I'll see you back in a year when you're actually diabetic, right? And when you're actually diabetic, then we'll give you diabetes medicine, which will only, you know, put a Band-Aid over the problem and not fix anything and not solve anything. But as far as they're concerned, diabetes is irreversible because if all you're going to do is give these horrible diabetes medications, it is irreversible. But instead, if we were to screen people properly and look at fasting glucose and make sure that people's fasting glucose was below 90 and look at fasting insulin and make sure that fasting insulin is between 2 and 5, and look at A1C and make sure that that A1C is less than 5, we wouldn't develop all of this chronic disease.
And what would you say to someone who didn't have optimal fasting glucose or A1C numbers?
Yeah. So the question is why? Are you eating a standard American diet or are you on a whole food diet? Are you moving your body? Or are you living a sedentary lifestyle? Are you prioritizing sleep? Or are you up at night on your phone or binging on Netflix or whatever?
Yeah, so much more to the picture than just like not eating too much sugar.
Right? Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have people that have beautiful, beautiful diets, but they're stress cases.
Mm-hmm.
So listen, if you are stressed out all the time, then the dominant hormone in your body is going to be cortisol. Cortisol is our run away from a tiger hormone. And if you need to run away from a tiger, you need high blood sugar in order to run away from said tiger.
Yeah.
Only there aren't any tigers. There's jobs and deadlines and busyness and sedentary lifestyle where you're not burning off any of that cortisol and difficult relationships and trauma and all of that. So if you're suffering under the weight of that, you're going to have metabolic dysfunction, and you can eat the most beautiful diet in the world, you're still going to have metabolic dysfunction. So there's so many layers to it, which is not to say that it's impossible,
mm-hmm.
but you have to work with someone who's educated.
Mm-hmm.
You have to work with someone who's aware, who can help you to recognize where this dysfunction is coming from.
How does muscle mass impact breast health?
So the more muscle mass you have, the better your metabolic health. And as we start to lose muscle mass, that is when we start to see dysfunction. And the reason we lose muscle mass is you're not getting enough protein in your diet. You are sedentary. You're not lifting heavy things. And or you're under too much stress.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these things are contributing to the same metabolic dysfunction that we spoke about before. And this becomes an increasing problem for everyone as they age, but not that I don't care about men, but my focus is on women's health. And women, as they start to go through menopause, so as they become perimenopausal and beyond, when you lose estrogen, you start to lose your metabolic flexibility. As you get older, you make less acid in your stomach. So you don't break down protein as well. You don't utilize your protein as well. So you can't incorporate it into your muscles. And most women do great when they're young with heavy duty cardio workouts and HIIT workouts and things like that. And if you don't shift to muscle building workouts as you go through menopause, you're going to lose your muscle mass and you're going to lose that flexibility and you're going to lose your metabolic health. So at different stages in your life, you have to make adjustments. Mm-hmm. And as you go through from your 30s to your 40s to your 50s, you have to start to prioritize more protein. You have to start prioritizing weightlifting and muscle building. And you have to start to come way more into circadian rhythm. And you have to start prioritizing sleep and changing what and when you eat. You have to start putting fasting into your routine. All of these things make a difference because as you get older, you lose flexibility. You lose ability to synthesize protein, to synthesize muscle, and you need to work harder at it.
Are you a fan of rucking or weighted best walking?
I am to an extent. I think you can overdo that. So I recently said to my husband, because he lost a lot of weight a few years ago, he's one of these up and down, down, but he's decisively been down for the last 2 years. And he's been walking with a 20-pound weighted vest and at the same time complaining of back pain.
Mm.
And I'm like, honey, there's a reason why we tell people to lose 20 pounds. It's because it's not particularly good for you to walk 5 miles every day with that old 20 pounds on you. So I think that adding it to certain things can be helpful, but I also think that we shouldn't be doing distance things with the weighted vest on.
Yeah, that's fair. I've been doing this a lot lately, and I used to do 20 pounds. I started with like 5 and I was like, this isn't doing anything. So then I went to 10, then 15, then 20. And now I'm back to 10. And I think I'm going to stay there because I did notice like a little bit of back pain when I was doing it often. But do you think women are more genetically equipped to do that than men? Just because I'm thinking like baby wearing, like you see pictures of women in Africa carrying huge water jugs. Like, is there any difference there between men and women?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I never really thought about it that way because we are, well, also, you know, when they're pregnant, they don't gain 50 pounds.
Yes.
Like many women in America do, right? They don't get to take a vacation from their life. They gain like 10 pounds.
Yep.
So yeah, maybe we are conditioned to do that a little more than men. However, we're also meant to have a different muscle to fat ratio than men. Men are actually more designed to have much more muscle mass than we are, because they typically had to go out and kill the animals and carry them back to the village. And that was pretty heavy, right? I don't know. I would have to think about that. But they also lived a far more nourishing life than most of us do.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're very lucky to be here on this beautiful farm and growing this beautiful food. There are many, many Americans, myself included, that we don't have the access to this. I mean, even what's at our markets it's not this.
Yeah.
If it's not this. So I think it's a nourishment thing too. And you really have to be conscious about it. It's something that, it's not to say that it can't be done. It can absolutely be done. But it's also not something that you can take for granted. Like, it has to be a very conscious part of your being. And you have to listen to yourself. You know, your body told you, no, this isn't working. I think women are much more dialed in to their body than men are.
Yeah,
and, right. And it's oftentimes when you're not dialed into your body, when you're not listening to your body, that's when you can get in trouble.
Yeah. It's like tuning in, paying attention, and changing based on what you're feeling.
I think that's tremendously important.
Yeah.
And if you are truly tuned into your body, if you're truly dialed into your health, it's not going to get away from you so much.
Uh-huh.
And the people that are surprised by their diagnoses, I think they're not so tuned into their health.
Yeah, absolutely. And you still see and treat breast cancer patients today, but very differently than before. Can you walk us through what that looks like now?
Absolutely. So, you know, before I was someone who focused on the tumor, but what we focus on grows, right? And that's not what we want to grow. We want our health to grow. We want our wellness to grow. We want our beauty to grow. We want our function to grow. That's what we want. And so that's where my focus is. And I try to not focus so much on the tumor. And it's so funny because as new people join my group, they all want to tell me like, oh, well, I had an ER PR positive this and a hormone negative that and a HER2 positive this. And we get so tuned into identifying with that cancer. We don't want to identify with cancer.
No.
So what I want to know about you is, what are you eating? How are you sleeping? How are you moving your body? What does your home look like? What does your environment look like? What are you putting in, on, and around you? What are your detoxification practices? What are your connections like? What are your relationships like? What is fulfilling you, right? What is filling your cup? What makes you happy? What brings you joy? And if you don't know the answers to those questions, right, then that's where the work is, right? Because when you build health, disease goes away. Now, the thing that I think is my special sauce, my unique approach, is that I'm looking at everyone from a genetic perspective. Not that breast cancer is a genetic disease. It's not. But we are all born with a finite capability to deal with environmental toxins, right? We all are born with a bucket. Some people have a really small bucket. Some people have a really big bucket. But when you've developed breast cancer, you have exceeded your toxin bucket, right? It is overflowing. You're out of balance. So I want to know, how do we empty your bucket? How do we help your body to, and how do we help you to create an environment inside and out that is going to build your health? So we do the genetic testing and we give people a plan and then we help work on it together as a group.
So you work on full body health based on genetics, because you just said that breast cancer is not a genetic disease, which I'm sure a lot of people argue with you on that point. What would you say to anyone who's adamant that no, this was a genetic thing, there's nothing I could have done about it?
Okay, well, even when you look at the BRCA population, right, these are people that are born with a mutation in one of the tumor suppressor genes, the BRCA1 or BRCA2 gene. And these people now have very high incidences of breast cancer, somewhere in the 80s, right? But when you looked at them 30 years ago, 40 years ago, because this mutation is not new.
Yeah.
But their breast cancer incidence was in the 50s. And if you look at them way before that, their breast cancer incidence was in the 30s.
Wow.
So the genes haven't changed. Mm-hmm. What's changed? Our environment has changed. Mm-hmm. And what we're doing with these people with genetic mutations is we're screening them early and we're screening them often.
And removing their breasts, right?
Yes.
In a lot of cases?
Yes. We're removing their breasts.
Before they even have
them. Their ovaries. Yes. But before they even get to that point, we're screening them. So we're just adding toxins to them. We're adding radiation. We're adding gadolinium. And if we put them on tamoxifen, we're adding a cancer-causing agent to them. So it is not your genes. And even in those BRCA mutation carriers that have an 80-some percent chance of developing breast cancer, there's still 15% of them, 17% of them that don't develop breast cancer. It's not your genes. Mm-hmm. It's the environment. And it's the way that your environment acts on your genes. And that's where our control lies. We can't control everything. Obviously, we can't control everything. But we can control a lot. And I assure you, we can control enough.
You mentioned fasting earlier. What role does fasting play in cancer prevention and treatment?
Yeah. So as a society, for the most part, we are overfed. We're overfed on everything. Food, light, electricity, everything. We're overfed on everything.
100%.
Every single religion has fasting built into it. Every single one. Because our ancestors knew that your body needs time to rest. Your body needs time to cleanse. Your body needs time to repair. And fasting is the fastest way to heal
it. Yeah, I think it was Paracelsus who called fasting the physician within the body, because it just cleans things up when you give your body a break from the constant inputs and digestion and all these things that you mentioned.
And also, you know, digestion takes a lot of energy and it detracts from our detoxification processes. So for instance, if you go to bed on a full stomach, your liver, which is supposed to be detoxifying all the things that it encountered during the day, can't do what it has to do because it's busy processing that meal.
Mm-hmm.
So at the very least, eating should stop hours before you go to sleep so that you can detoxify overnight. But even more importantly is that, remember, we are modern beings living on a very old gene code. And there were times of food abundance and there were times of great scarcity. And the only reason that any of us are alive today is because we were able to survive those times of great scarcity.
Yeah.
And, you know, it wasn't as if we couldn't perform during those times. Because if you think about it, if you came out of the cave in the morning and you saw a saber-toothed tiger because you're coming out of the cave to go hunting or whatever, it's not like you could say to that tiger, hey, can you just hold on a second because I haven't had my breakfast.
Right.
Right? Like, we were meant to perform as well, if not better, in a fasted state than we are in a fed state.
Totally agree. I mean, I do some fasting on and off, and I feel like all of my instincts are heightened and sharpened when I'm in a fasted state.
Exactly.
My ring. Okay, we just had a first. We had a power outage at the farm, but we're back up and running now.
Hat blew.
Yeah.
Gusty wind.
We're back up. So as you're talking about this, I'm just thinking about how many critics there are about women who fast and people who say that women shouldn't fast. What would you say to them, and how can women incorporate fasting in a way that works with their biology and not against it?
Yeah. So we have to remember, again, modern beings living on a very old gene code. We all fasted.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
It's not like we could open the refrigerator in the cave. Like, it didn't exist.
Yeah.
So there were times of food plenty and times of food scarcity. And when there was no food, we did not eat. So we can all fast. Fasting, actually, incidentally, is also the fastest way to healing. Because that's when our cells are able to clean up and regenerate and decide which cells should be destroyed and which cells can be repaired. So it is a very important process. I think for women, we need to think about both stage. Like, are you of childbearing age? Because if you are, there are times in the month where you will tolerate fasting and times of the month where you will not.
What are those times?
So, and Mindy Pels wrote an amazing book.
Yeah, right. Great.
So I often refer to her book all the time. And women, as they get to the end of their cycle, in the luteal phase of their cycle, they need more carbohydrate. They need more rest. They just won't tolerate as much in the luteal phase of their cycle as they will in the follicular phase of their cycle. So, or in the proliferative phase of their cycle. So for women, I don't think that you should do a tremendous amount of fasting as you approach your cycle. I think that is a time that's very hard for women, and you need more carbohydrate, you need more TLC, you need more rest.
Agreed.
So in the first part of your cycle, that's probably a better time for prolonged fasting. But I believe that everyone should be doing these overnight fasts. I believe everyone should have time-restricted eating. As the day goes on, our metabolism drops. We have a decreased ability to process food as the day goes on. And certainly at night, we are supposed to be doing all these detoxification processes. So as the sun goes down, we're not supposed to be eating after dark. If you were out after dark in cave times, you were someone else's food. Right? So I think everyone should be doing these overnight fasts.
How often would you recommend?
This is all the time. Like, even babies. Once
you're saying just like from sundown to sunup.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. We should not be eating when the sun is down.
Yeah.
We are not built for that.
So like circadian fasting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Circadian fasting.
Very gentle.
Which also means that that is going to change according to the time of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And when our days are long, our fasts are shorter, right? We can have longer periods of eating as the days are longer. And when the days are short, so are our eating windows. And those fasts get longer. So it depends on the time of the year. And then as you get older, you will tolerate longer periods of fasting when your body is not in that same menstrual cycle and that same menstrual rhythm. So I think that fasting changes at different stages of your life and at different times of the year. And I think that that's really important for a lot of things, because there's not going to be one diet that's right for you for the entirety of your life. That's going to change. And the amount of fasting that you're going to do throughout your life, that's going to change. But most people in this country are so overfed,
yeah,
they need to be doing way more fasting than they're doing. So instead of criticizing people for fasting, we should encourage them to be doing fasting.
Yeah. I was always someone who I would have like a snack in the morning, then breakfast, maybe a snack between breakfast and lunch, and then lunch, dinner, maybe a bedtime snack. And so when I first started fasting, it was difficult to shorten my eating window.
Because you had no metabolic flexibility.
Yes. Yeah, it was hard.
You were a grazer.
Uh-huh. And it didn't feel good in the beginning. But then I did develop more metabolic flexibility, and I noticed that my brain was sharper when I was fasted, and it didn't feel super difficult or draining. I would actually get more energy out of it.
Yes.
And I did quite a bit of fasting, like in between my second and third child, probably more than most people would recommend. Maybe it was too much. I don't do as much now, but I still was able to get pregnant without trying, like very easily, even doing way more fasting than most people would say is good for women. So I just think there's a lot more to the story there.
Fasting leads to metabolic flexibility. And if you can't fast, it's because you're metabolically inflexible.
Mm-hmm.
So your takeaway from not being able to fast should be, you need to work on this.
Yeah.
Because we should be able to, without an issue, go for prolonged periods without food and be sharp as a tack.
Yeah.
And be strong and be resilient. We should be able to do all of that. And if you can't do that, that's where your work is. That's where you need to focus. That's what you need to do. Because we must all be metabolically flexible, because that is a sign of health.
Yeah. What role do the synthetic chemicals in the personal care and beauty products that women are using play in our risk for breast cancer?
So, unfortunately, it goes so unrecognized because it's presenting at different stages in different ways, and people don't realize it. So all of these chemicals, these are xenoestrogens, X-E-N-O, xenoestrogens, and they are acting on our estrogen receptor and blocking our estrogen receptor from receiving the estrogen that our body is making. And so in young girls, it's presenting as menstrual irregularities and painful periods and things that we call estrogen dominance, which is actually progesterone deficiency. And then as you get into your 20s and 30s, it's presenting as infertility. And if it's not acknowledged, if it's not stopped, then you get to your 40s and 50s, and now you're in my office with breast cancer. And this is what's happening because it is disrupting our normal hormonal rhythm. It is preventing our hormones from doing what they are supposed to do because our hormones are protecting us. They're not hurting us. But if our receptor sites that are the way that our hormones message our cells, if they're occupied by plastics, by fragrance, by nonstick, by all of these things that are surrounding us these days and totally unregulated and totally accepted, even something like antibiotics. People don't realize that antibiotics are a xenoestrogen. And so
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So they think it's so harmless, but the antibiotics are put everywhere in places that you don't even think about it. In your toothpaste, in your shampoo, in your conditioner.
Triclosan.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So this is contributing to this dysfunction that just goes unrecognized for what it is. And we need to be paying far more attention. But instead, because the conventional medical world doesn't think about it systemically, because the conventional medical world isn't trained to think this way, what happens? A young girl comes with menstrual irregularity, and what happens? She gets put on birth control pills. Or you present with infertility in your 30s, and what happens? You get put on some regimen which forces a pregnancy. Or you present with acne, what happens? They put you on birth control pills.
That was me. And,
yeah.
And antibiotics.
And antibiotics, right? And that's what they do. And instead, and what should be happening is we should recognize that this is hormone dysfunction and fix it. But instead, what's happening is we're just mansplaining it, right? We're just going to overrule it with more things that are cancer-causing until what happens is you end up with a breast cancer diagnosis.
How does the birth control pill specifically impact cancer risk?
Well, we know from the Danish study of 1.8 million women that breast cancer incidence is directly related to the amount of time that you're on birth control pills. And birth control pills, because again, it's a product of the pharmaceutical industry, these are, well, they're all synthetic, so I don't want to say synthetic, but these are non-bioidentical estrogens. These are estrogens that come from pregnant horses, and pregnant horses have forms of estrogen that we don't know in our body. Over 30 forms of estrogen that our bodies don't know and don't know what to do with.
I didn't realize that it came from pregnant horses.
Oh, yes.
Wow.
Premarin is pregnant mare urine.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yep.
And there's like, so going back to the xenoestrogens real quick, there was a study I have here in my notes in 2023 that found that reducing exposure to xenoestrogens, which can appear as parabens or phthalates in personal care products, can actually reverse cancer-associated changes in breast tissue.
So just by eliminating them.
Yeah. So but yeah, also a lot of hope, like the changes that we make actually make a difference.
Absolutely. And that is what this whole story is about. That is what my whole platform is about. We have so much more power than we think, so much more power than we've led to believe.
Yeah.
And my story is one of hope because you can replace whatever dysfunction you have encountered up until this day with hope, with health. And I think at any age, at any stage, you can have health. And sometimes, when you get to the lowest of the low, when you present with a diagnosis that you never saw coming, that you never expected, it's not in your family, and you didn't feel unwell, right? And you're hit with this diagnosis, this can be opportunity. It's not a blessing. I understand your diagnoses are not blessings, but they are blessed opportunities, and they are opportunity to have health like you never had before. But it comes with awareness and with the fact that there is no doctor, no nurse, no provider, no hospital, no doctor's office, no treatment suite that can make you healthy. The only thing that can make you healthy is you. And health happens at home with the things that you do every single day.
Dr. Jen, thank you so much. This has been such an enlightening conversation. Where can people find you and continue to learn from you and learn more about your clinics that you're opening? Where should people go?
Yeah. So if you're looking for breast imaging, my centers are called Perfection Imaging, and Perfection is spelled with QT in the middle. And if you sign up for our newsletter, you can find out where Perfection Imaging is opening near you. Of course, I want everyone to be doing their self-breast examinations and doing the ARIA, A-U-R-I-A dot care test, code DrJen20. And you can find me on all the social channels. I'm at Dr. Jen Simmons, and my Jen has two N's. Can I take my book from here?
Yes, please.
And show everyone that this is the Smart Woman's Guide to Breast Cancer. And literally, this book is the breast owner's guide.
The breast Bible.
Yes. You do not have to have breast cancer to get tremendous value for this book. And I spent a year and a half of my life away from my life, away from my family, to put this out there. So please, if you want to have better health, you can find out the recipe for better health right here. And I have my own podcast. It's called Keeping Abreast with Dr. Jen, and we put out a new episode every week. And then my medical practice is realhealthmd.com. And there you can learn all about our programs of how to reclaim your health after a breast cancer diagnosis. And we just launched a prevention program for anyone who has a clinically positive ARIA test, or you're a mutation carrier, or you just want to know how to avoid breast cancer. This prevention program is for you.
Oh, that was so good, so encouraging. Thank you. I know you're up against a lot with the things that you're saying and the information that you're putting out there. So I just really appreciate you and everything that you're putting out into the world.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I so appreciate being able to be here in this beautiful, beautiful setting and having these amazing conversations that are so important to have. And the more conversations that we have, the more educated people will be, and hopefully will just help to open people's eyes to the truth and allow people to make informed decisions, because that is not what's happening now. And people don't make the right choices because they don't even know what the right choices are. So I'm so grateful for people like you, for your platform, and for people like you that are putting things out into the world so that people can make good choices.
Thank you so much.